If you're of a certain age, you know this song.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
Patti Smith from her landmark album, Horses. I remember the year it came out. I was in college in Philadelphia, and for a while, it's all any of us listened to. Patti Smith was the great punk rock poet of the 70s, the singer who brought Rambo and beat poetry into rock and roll. In the early 80s, Patti Smith married fellow musician Fred Sonic Smith, and she disappeared from the music scene. The two of them moved to Detroit, they raised two children, and when Fred died too young in 1994, Patti moved back to New York and she took up music again. Today she still tours, but now she's also made her name as a writer. Her memoir, Just Kids, won the National Book Award, and she's got a new book out, M-Train, another memoir, but this time it's a story told in fragments, memories of Fred, elegies to her favorite writers, and as Steve Paulson discovered, even dreams.
It's not so easy writing about nothing. That's what a cowpoke was saying as I entered the frame of a dream. Vaguely handsome, intensely laconic, he was balancing on a folding chair, leaning backwards, his Stetson brushing the edge of the dun-colored exterior of a lone cafe. He just pulled the brim of his hat over his eyes and kept on talking. "But we keep on going," he continued, "fostering all kinds of crazy hopes to redeem the lost, some sliver of personal revelation. It's an addiction, like playing the slots or a game of golf." The sun caught the edge of his belt buckle, projecting a flash that shimmered across the desert plain. "I've been here before, haven't I?" He just sat there, staring out at the plain. "Son of a bitch," I thought. "He's ignoring me."
That is wonderful. So was this actually one of your dreams?
Yes. I often record my dreams, and especially if I think they might be usable or transformable into something else. But this one intrigued me. And I was sitting in the cafe and I wrote it down. And as I wrote it down, I thought, it is easy writing about nothing. I could write about nothing all day. So I decided that I was just going to sit there and write about nothing. And that was the genesis of M-Train.
So I have to ask you, what do you mean when you say you're writing about nothing?
Well, for me, writing about nothing means no agenda, no particular direction, no sense of responsibility to chronology, plot. You know, it's like automatic writing in a way. It could also be saying the same as writing about everything.
And there definitely is a dreamlike quality to this book. And I mean, you're talking about various episodes from your life, but it's not so much a memoir like your earlier book, Just Kids, but it's sort of these vignettes and reflections that keep jumping around in time.
I think the dreamlike quality is because I spend a lot of time on my own and I travel by myself a lot and I live alone. I mean, I don't have a companion at this time in my life. So I'm almost never with another person unless it's work oriented or with my kids. But in general, when I'm traveling without my band, I'm by myself.
What does the title of your book, M-Train, refer to?
Mind. I thought of that immediately because it's a train of thought. I didn't want to call it Mind Train because it reminded me of the, you know, the song, "Get on board, love train," you know, that. Mm-hmm. I didn't want people to think of like a song or, so I just thought M-Train gave it a little air of mystery.
Yeah. Now, one of the tools in your toolkit, it would seem, is the photographs you take with your Polaroid camera. And you've included a bunch of these pictures in the book. And I get the sense that you feel almost compelled to document certain things you've seen, places you've visited through your photos. Why are they so important to you?
Well, I think of them sort of as evidence. Like, I take two different kinds of photographs, some as an artist, but other ones are really like my souvenirs or scrapbook pictures. Or like I often think that if my work was a crime, they would sort of be the forensic evidence. So, It's also to share with people. Because of my touring, I sometimes are in 40 cities in 50 days. And sometimes I go to very obscure places. And I think, well, most people won't go to see Sylvia Plath's grave. It's not easy to get to. But I can take a picture and share it. Or, you know, most people aren't going to go up the mountain and, you know, in Lugana to find Hermann Hesse's typewriter. But yeah. I did. So if I take a picture of it, then other people can see it.
So I have to ask you about this because I just found this totally fascinating as I was reading this. I mean, you have what are essentially elegies for clearly some of your favorite writers. You know, you've just mentioned a couple, Hermann Hesse, Sylvia Plath. I mean, there's Roberto Bolaño, Murakami, Jean Genet, you know, the list goes on. And you've made pilgrimages to a lot of, I mean, homes where they used to live, Bolaño in Spain, Frida Kahlo in Mexico. And you visited a lot of their graves, Bertolt Brecht in Germany, Mishima in Japan, Wittgenstein's grave in Cambridge, England, where I've also been to. Why do you go to these places? Why are they so important to you?
Well, I like to go. I mean, I find it, you know, magical that you can be in the proximity of a person's resting place. Cemeteries are often very beautiful. But also, sometimes I just go to thank the person.
It's so interesting to hear you say that because I love cemeteries. They're among my favorite places to visit. I mean, there are some people who think, my God, that's kind of morbid, but...
But it's not at all. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you can feel. To me, it's like any place where there's a lot of human emotion. You go into a church. I go to a lot of churches on the road to light candles or say a prayer. And I don't have any religion, but I like to go because these are houses where so many people have wept, have prayed, have felt joy, suffering.
Now, I have to ask you about the books that you write about and the books that you gravitate to. Because, I mean, you write about masterpieces at one point. You say there are two kinds of masterpieces. There are the classic monumental books like Moby Dick or Wuthering Heights. And then there's a different kind of book, what you call devastating books, like Bolaño's 2666, Murakami's The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. Are these books that kind of, when you read them, they just took hold of you? They possessed you?
Oh, yes. I mean, the first book that did that for me was The Glass Bead Game. Well, I mean, I could go back, and yes, it was Peter Pan, it was Little Women, but I mean in terms of a great masterwork.
Hermann Hesse's The Glass Bead Game.
Yes. That book I read over and over. It helped reset the way my mind works and the way my creative mind works. I felt like I would never as a writer be the same.
I just don't know what to do tonight. My head is aching as I drink and breathe. Memory falls like cream in my bones. Moving a mouse.
Do you think of yourself mainly as a writer? Because, of course, you're best known. You're famous for your music, for being a punk rock legend. But how do you see yourself?
Well, since I was a child, I wanted to write. I've written all my life. It's the one consistent thing I do. When I left the public eye for 16 years, when I got married, I didn't perform for 16 years. I didn't... to much of anything connected with music or the music business, except privately with Fred at home. But I wrote every day and really developed my craft in those 16 years. And it's the thing that I imagine I'll be doing for the rest of my life. I never planned to be a singer. I never dreamed of having a rock and roll band. Those things happened sort of organically, serendipitously. I'm really happy that I did and proud of my band's accomplishments. And really, because of it, I was able to see the world. But still, I think of myself as a writer.
Of course, you do perform a lot now. I mean, you've gone back to music. I assume that gives you pleasure.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't do it. But, you know, performing is a whole different aspect of yourself than writing. Writing is very solitary. You don't need anybody. You don't need anything to write. You need paper and a pencil. That's all you need. And it's a very introspective work where performing is all public and it's all collaboration because you're collaborating with your fellow musicians, your band, your technicians. Performance doesn't belong to anyone. It's a product of everyone having a common mind and making a night happen. So it's a beautiful thing, but it's almost the entire opposite. It's like I'm like a bipolar artist because one part of me is very public and the other part of me is just like a lone wolf.
Well, part of the private side of this book is the way you write about grief. You write about your mother's death, your brother's, especially your husband's, Fred, who died way too young in 1994. And you're never straightforward about how you write about these things, but you have all kinds of just incredibly poignant passages about loss, about the emptiness that followed. Were these parts hard to write?
A few of them were hard. I can actually say that I cried when I wrote a couple of them. I know the parts that contain weeping, not always the ones that people would think.
This little song is for Fred.
Sometimes a joyful passage will make me cry because it, or something that's so full of hope that it'll simultaneously make me sad.
It's been a hard time and when it rains, it rains on me. The sky just opens and when it rains, it pours.
There are, I mean, some of the most poignant passages are when you talk about you're slipping into a light but lingering malaise, not a depression, more like a fascination for melancholia. And there's a fair amount of melancholy in this book, isn't there?
Well, I mean, it's a light melancholy. I'm not a depressive kind of person. I mean, sometimes I'll cry. The other night, I couldn't sleep, and I woke up in the middle of the night and saw A Beautiful Mind again. Russell Crowe always reminds me of Fred. And every time I see that movie, I could cry for a half an hour. But it's all right. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. I don't walk around depressive. You know, melancholy can be somewhat beautiful, you know. I mean, sometimes I do feel a sudden, terrible pain, missing my brother, missing my mother. But, you know, you ride it out. And then you're back on your feet.
Yeah.
But at that time when I started writing this book, I did get into this very uncharacteristic malaise. It just went on and on. By the end, I realized it was just probably part of the aging process and suddenly becoming aware that I was an age. Because I've always been sort of Peter Pan-ish. You know, I never really was concerned about my age, never really even hardly noticed it. But all of a sudden, the numbers, as they get higher, you're forced to look at them, you know, 65, yeah. 66. This year, in December, I'll be 70. That's a real number. So it's a number to look at and examine and think, okay, if I'm 70, I have a finite time. So I have to think about how much time do I have left to do my work, to watch my children grow, to be productive, to be useful. And these were new thoughts for me.
Now, I'm wondering if we could end with one final passage from your book. And this is from back when you were living in Michigan or reflecting on it. And
I actually would like to choose a different
one. Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yes.
And the reason is because the paperback version has 20 new pages. And I thought it would be nice to read something that people haven't heard, if that's okay
with
you.
I'd love that. Yes, please.
Okay, it's Christmas time, and my daughter, Jessie, and I are walking around New York, and it was a very strange Christmas, unseasonably warm, and I think I felt a little disconnected. Jessie and I are shopping, so I'll bring you in the middle of our shopping.
Okay.
It was so mild that we decided to walk home. As we passed a salvage place, I noticed an old metal sign spelling cafe with tiny colored lights. We entered just to look. We wandered about, admiring polished wood drafting tables, church pews, airplane propellers, and an ornate desk. Jesse had lingered by an old ship's wheel. "Do you like nautical things?" asked the shopkeeper. "Yes," she answered, but I could hear her thinking. "My dad liked them too." I suddenly felt very sad. We live in the time frame of AF, after Fred, bound by love and irreplaceable loss. "You're tired," I told myself and looked up. And there before me was the object that had transformed and re-energized the atmosphere, a true object of desire. A time-stained tag identified it simply, 19th century wishing well. The well, as if it had materialized from childhood, where I had tossed coins that were wishes spanning time. "Jesse, Jesse," I called, hardly able to speak. She joined me immediately, and we stood before it, of one mind, in rapt silence. "Make a wish," we both said.
"Night, a nine of diamonds, a woman lay and cried at the Sister of Mercy on the Sabbath day."
That's the great musician and poet Patti Smith. She talked with Steve Paulson about her new book, M Train.